This is a Gathering Heritage project interview recorded in County Louth in Ireland.
Now, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Colette O'Hagan to our Gathering Heritage project. Now, we all know, of course, listening to all the interviews that Colette has done over the years, and it's all about marathon running. But today we are going to try and get a bit of what the lady is like behind her running, and it's a completely different life we're going to talk about, Colette.
Yeah, we are indeed. We're going to go back to my childhood and then my life as a foster parent and working with the children in Romania in orphanages and the Chernobyl Respite Project.
Right. Now, let's start from where were you from and where did your mum and dad, where did your dad work? Just tell me a little bit about your family.
Well, I was born into a farming family on the Louth Armagh border. We had a farmyard and a shop, and my dad was obviously the farmer. And I grew up on the Louth Armagh border, and we had a big family. There was 18 of us all together. Not all of us, the whole lot of us together. Obviously, some of us would move out, and then there was more in. But anyway, I grew up on the border, and because of the proximity to the border, I went to school in Northern Ireland. So we had the farm and the shop, and sometimes in our school bags we'd be smuggling little bits of things, but we didn't really realise that we were doing it. My mum would say, "Will you take that over to the shop across the border?" So we would do that. So there was butter and God knows what else was in our bags. But No, actually, we were never actually stopped. And at the time that it was the 50s, and there was a regiment in from the Beast Specials, I think they were. And no, they never bothered us, but there was a lot of activity going on that we wouldn't really understand what was going on. There was a lot of the time that the border was blown up, and there'd be a big crater in the road, and we'd be jumping into the big hole in the road and enjoying that bit of crack. And then, sure, the next thing, the local lads would have the hole in the road filled up again, and so the army come back again and do it up again. And then the next thing, they put in spikes across the road, the iron spikes, and so the lads cut them down, and it was just useless, you know.
Did you take that as a bit of fun?
Yes.
You hadn't a clue totally, what was going on.
We enjoyed the whole crack. We didn't know what was going on. Yeah. So to be honest, one of them spikes ended up in a house, my first home that myself and my husband had, because we're going to do an extension, and the extension involved taking the wall down of the home, but they needed a girder. So where did we find the girder? Only one of the spikes that used to be across the road to block us, whatever. I don't know what the spikes were about, because nobody had cars those days, so it was all, everybody had a bike or whatever, so you still get across the border quite easily. But anyway, one of those girders ended up on our first home, propping up the roof.
There's a memory and a half, isn't it?
Good memory, good memory.
You just passed over very quickly there. There was 18 in your house.
Yeah, a big family, my parents had obviously a big family. But and do you know what? I actually enjoy being part of a big family. As I often say to people, we had nothing, but we had everything. Because we made up our toys. Our toys were all stuff we made ourselves. Like, we'd have sticks and we'd put them, tied them together, and we'd have, that would be our dolls, and the boys would have different things that they'd made up themselves. And in those days, everything was very simple. And we had a big farmyard, and in the yard we'd skip in the evenings, and we'd be skipping, and the boys would be playing skittles at the crossroads and stuff like that. It was all kind of made up stuff, and we were happy because we didn't know any difference. So,
and what did your dad do?
He was a farmer. He manned the farm. Now, it wasn't a big farm. It was a small farm hold, but we had pigs and hens and chickens and turkeys, and we had a big dray horse that did all the ploughing and stuff like that. And we had a big incubator. I remember the milk house where we had a big incubator and all the little chickens. I remember the chickens hatching out and stuff like that. And then we used to make the butter in the milk, in the churn. You know, you'd turn the handle and your hand would be falling off you by the time you had the butter made. But we used to have to pat it together then on the little pads.
So everybody and then helped.
We had our chores to do before we went to school. We were only 5 and 6, carrying water from the well into the house, put it on the range, because the range had a big boiler on it, and that was the hot water for us. And the range was the whole entire cooker for the house. We had the oven on that, and the hot water, and the hob on the top where the kettle was always boiling, and the tea was always ready. Do you know that kind of a way? And then we had the shop with all the little, it was more a grocery shop like kind of thing that would have been more basic than.
Did your mum run?
It all belonged, in a sense, to my granny. My granny and granddad owned it, but my dad was the youngest of them, and he was farm. My other uncle and my aunts, he had two brothers, I think it was, and one sister, but the two brothers lived in Dundalk and were quite successful businessmen, and then the sister lived in Cross Midlen.
So when you say 18, there was very few families had that amount of children.
Yes, there
so
was.
So was it a struggle money-wise with just being a small farmer trying to keep the bread on the table?
Oh, there was always a struggle. But my mum used to make a lot of stuff. We also, even though there were so many, we always were sort of self-sufficient in that we had a vegetable garden, and that was our potatoes and our veg, and there was fruit growing in the garden as well. But it was a struggle, to be honest. But the thing was, we didn't know any better. We thought everybody was the same. And as you said, that was quite a big family. There was another family not far away from us, and there was 22 in it. So that wasn't normal. We were probably a small family in comparison to them.
No comparisons, only
to
them.
No, but everything was relative to the time, and we all didn't know any better. We went to school and we had wellies on us going to school, and we were lucky probably to have wellies on us going to school, because a lot of kids had no shoes. You know, that kind of a way. So
the Wellingtons were used for Sundays and everything.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Welly was one of the main attraction. Then,
where,
the Wellies,
where did you come in the family?
I was sort of maybe midway, do you know. But we used to go to school across the fields. So that'd be the shortcut. So we'd be running. That's probably where I started my running career, I'd say, when I was quite small. We'd run across the fields and see how long it took us to get to school.
So you got your training there.
Yeah, I got a bit of training in then. So background training.
Yeah. And where did you go when you got a job? Were you good at school, for instance? Were you a good scholar?
Yeah, well, I was sort of maybe the quietest one, I assume, anyway, because I was my granny's favourite. My granny took favouritism to me, and she could see that I wanted to read a lot. And I was a good reader, and probably, you know, very high in the class with reading and spellings and stuff like that. But she could see that I wanted to do well in my education. So she sent me to boarding school. So I was only one. It sounds very posh that you were boarding school in that era, but I went to boarding school, and it really did stand to me because I got a good education. And then I wanted to be a teacher. So when I left boarding school, I was I was in my teens, and I had all my ambition was to be a teacher. But at the time, we didn't have a lot of money. And my dad says, no, I'm sorry, but we needed to go out to work. So I ended up working in a factory.
Well, did you resent that a bit
at
the time?
Yes, I did at the time. Yeah, I did. I really wanted to be a teacher, and that was my ambition. I was really upset when I was sent to the factory. However, it turned out that it was an omen in a sense. That determined my fate, because I ended up meeting my husband, and I got married very young. And I was 19, and then this next month, we are 50 years married. So it was meant to happen. So I was thinking, if I had to take the road of going down the road of being a teacher, I might never have met Larry, and God knows what way my life would have taken or what turn my life. So sometimes things happen for the better. You may, at the time, you may be saying, oh, why did this happen to me? But there may be a reason behind it. And this is obviously the reason. At the time, I couldn't see it, but obviously it was meant to happen. So now when I look back, now, I'm happy enough about that.
Tell me a little bit about your own family then with Larry, and how you got involved in the first fostering or going to Romania.
Yeah, well, obviously I had it in me, because when I was growing up, we were always minding another child, another baby, changing nappies, feeding the baby, because my mum was a very busy mum out on the farm. So I was used to looking after children, and I actually loved it. So we had our own children, and I decided one day, I said to Larry, do you know what, I wouldn't mind fostering. So when he was in agreement with that, now he wouldn't have come from a big family himself, but he was in agreement with that. So we applied, and we weren't long before we were assessed.
What did foster, how did it come into your mind though? You had your own family at this time.
Yeah, we had our own family at this time, and we didn't want to have any more children as such, but we thought we had room for more children. And I had that nurturing and nature in me that I wanted to, you know, nurture children and look after them. So,
Were you talking about children now, not teenagers or anything like that? Was children?
Most. Yeah, it was children or babies even at that stage. So, so we started in 1986 to foster.
And did you get, at that time, was it easier or was it as difficult as it is now with all the checking and everything?
No, it was more simple years ago. And we applied and we were assessed and pretty quickly we had our first child and it kind of ballooned from that. So we, over the years, we fostered several children and I have to say I don't regret fostering kids, but I can see a lot of changes in the time from we started to now and how it has evolved. Some are for the better and some are not so good. Like when we started, I look at a child as if it was my own. So when I take a child into my home, I treat it as it is my own. It is mine for the time it's with me. So I want to give that child the best chance. So if you're treating your child that's in your home like your own, you can't go far wrong, to be honest. So that was my policy. Always try and to treat them like they were my own children. But the thing about fostering is when you start fostering, you have to remember it's a team. Your husband has to be agreement and your children. Because I always say to my own children, you must remember you fostered as well as we did. It's not all about us. It's about you as well.
What age were your children when you first fostered?
Oh, my youngest would have been about 7. And my oldest probably about 14. But they loved it. They actually took to it very easily and they were great. And many a time they come home from school, be another child in the house. But they didn't bat an eyelid and they didn't mind sharing their stuff. I think it taught them a lot because they realise now we're not, you know, the only children in the world. There is children in the world that need love and attention and they don't have it and it's not their fault. It's, you know, there's reasons why they're in care and stuff like that. Now, I don't really like that word in care, but they're just, it's the way the word is used nowadays. But yeah, when we started it was quite simple in a sense, and then obviously it was under the help board then, and it was called boarded out children or something like that, which probably sounds a little bit better in a sense. But then it went from the help board to the HSE and then from the HSE to Tulsa,
the modern one is now
quite different. There's a lot more, I suppose, now because the population has grown and we've an awful lot of health and safety regulations. Plus, it's not a bad idea, really. You have to look after it yourself. So there's a lot of safe care. So foster parents now have to look after themselves and be sure that they're safe and they know the safe care plan. So you have a lot more training to do before you become a foster parent nowadays.
Can I go back to the first child that you fostered? And what age was the child?
Oh, a baby. It was a baby about a couple of months old.
So how long had you got that?
Forever. Like, we up to teenage and everything. Yeah, that baby stayed with me. Yeah.
And was that the idea or was it only supposed to be for a
wee
while?
No, it really does depend. I went into kind of long-term fostering. You can go into long-term, short-term, or you can go into respite, which means that our emergency care. So that you're available if there's an emergency. So I prefer the long term because you get to know the kids better and you can do a bit of work with them.
And you made that decision before you started. So it was a hell of a commitment to make, wasn't it, Colette?
Yeah, we were young then, so we were well able for it. You know what I mean? So I really loved doing it. And I loved my children when they were growing up. I actually loved when they were on holidays. Do you know where sometimes school holidays come and every parent's saying, oh, what am I going to do with them? I was happy out when my kids were on holidays because they were with me. So I kind of basically grew up with my own kids. If you can get, because I was quite young when I married, so we kind of grew up together, and it was really nice. I loved it, and I really loved having, and I loved having the foster kids. I'm not saying it wasn't challenging; it was. There was times some of the kids had problems and stuff like that, but you face the challenges, and if you can't help do something for them, you try and work with the social worker or whoever's looking after the child.
It is a very big commitment, though, isn't it? When you, because you know, I know you said that you treat them as your own, but maybe when things would go wrong, maybe it might have, you might be thinking about it the other way.
Yeah, it, yeah, you have to really think, because you're very open to allegations as a foster parent, and you have to be very aware of that. So that's one of the big things, that some foster parents have been lost through allegations. A lot of them would be obviously false, because sometimes the natural parents would resent you looking after their child, and they might say something to the child, or just say such and such hit you or someone's, whatever.
Would they know who was fostering them?
Generally, they didn't used to know, but nowadays they might. Do you know? Yeah, because they used to know when we started. It wasn't, and we never took them to respite, you know, or to meet the, you know, the way like where they meet with their parents. But nowadays, all the foster parents have to do that now. They have to pick the child.
So their parents never saw them.
Oh, they did see them, but the social worker took the children to see the parents, where the foster parents weren't involved that way. But now in the new rules now, the foster parents take the children to see their parents.
And could it was a worry that the parents might get the child back, because you're doing it long term, you know. But after a couple of months, could they ask to have the children back, we're okay now, or whatever the problem is?
Well, they could ask, but it would have to be through the social workers and Tulsa and all that. They would decide whether the child's come back to the parents, and they would just have to wait, work and see how. We all work together in a sense, like they try, well, the kids are in our care, the social workers are working with the parents. But the end of the day is, the fostering is about looking after the children until such times as they can go back to their parents. And if that, sometimes that doesn't happen, and a lot of the times it does.
Did it happen with some of your children that you were fostering, and was it a very sad time for you when you had to give them back?
Yeah, I have to say that, and I wanted to actually do an article on when children that you've been looking after for a few years in your home and they leave you. And you know they're going back to a happier place in a sense, because they're going back to their natural family, which is a good thing. But the thing is, and nobody seems to realise this, is that the foster parents grieve. We actually grieve for them children. Like, it's like someone's, you go up to the room that's been in maybe 2 or 3 years, that child's been in that room, and all the little things that they've had in the room and stuff like that. It's their room, and they get that room, that's their room till they leave the house. So you walk into the room and they're not there anymore, and there is that sense of loss in a way, although you know it's not a bad loss, but to you it is a loss. So there's a part of you goes with the child in a sense, and then you do adjust eventually, but you do grieve inside for that child that has left.
Would the children know about you? Do you ever see them afterwards, or is there any connection there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've seen quite a few of them, and in the minute I'm in the process of writing a book on it's an autobiography, and I'm going to touch on the fostering, and I'm going to get a few of the kids that stayed here, just write a little synopsis of what it was like living in the O'Hagan household. As I said, the little piece that they write won't have to put their names on it, but they're quite willing to do that.
I love that, the O'Hagan household.
Yeah.
And it gives the feeling of warmth to the children.
Yeah. They're part of the family. And we always, when we had the kids with us, we always took the foster kids on holidays. We were going on holidays, they came. We didn't look for respite for them to go somewhere else while we were on holidays.
And
we
always took them. Had you complete control over them while they were with you? You could take them on holidays and everything.
Well, but to a degree, if they obviously, we wanted to take them on holidays, the social worker would intervene and ask the natural parents, was that okay? And then sometimes you might have to get passports for them, so you'd have to go through that process with the natural parents to get them. But we took a lot of the kids that we fostered on holidays with us, because they're part of our family after all at the time they were here.
Did you get on with the parents, the natural parents? Were you in contact with them, and are you still in contact with them?
Well, I would personally get on very well with them, because at the end of the day, they are the parents, and I respect them for that. And I would always say at the end to them, I am only doing a job while you are not able to do the job. These kids will be going back to you. I never made them feel like that they were, you know, I was better than them, because I, you know, sometimes some of the natural parents would resent the fact that you're actually looking after their children. That could make them feel a little bit bad about themselves. But I never wanted them to feel like that. to some reason or other, they couldn't look after them at the time. Maybe they were sick and there was a few addiction problems in with some of the parents. Until they were better, then they would get their children back. But I never wanted them to feel inferior to me because I'm looking after their children.
What age now would the children that you fostered range from that's away now?
They would be in the, from the 30s down.
And did you ever get, we'll say, if they got married, and ever, would they take you to the wedding? Or
yes, I've been invited to weddings and christenings and stuff like that from children that I've looked
so
after.
So that's a lovely thing.
That is nice, yeah, yeah, that is. And we've gone there too, yeah, yeah. You know.
So how long is it since you had your the last child staying here?
Oh, we're still fostering.
You were still fostering?
Yeah, we're currently fostering.
Right.
Yeah, we have been doing it since, as I said, 1986, and we're currently fostering.
And you, of course, now you have another string to your bow. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with the orphanages.
Well, how I got involved with the Romanian orphanages as foster parent, I was at a foster care conference, and there was this woman from Cork who had gone out to Romania just shortly after Ceausescu's fall, and she had told me about it, and she said, would you like to come out with us? And I said, there were a group from Cork, and I said, oh, I'd love to come out with you. So I went off out with them. And
had you any idea what you were going out to?
No, and I'll never forget it, because it really left its mark on me when I went to the orphanage. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it was the most lonely and desolate place I've ever seen. At the time, because of Ceausescu's reign, they were all kind of in the mindset that the children that were in the orphanage deserved to be in the orphanage, and they were treated so badly. And that's the way the mindset of the villagers were. The villagers wouldn't even walk past the orphanage. And if they did have to walk, they'd spit at the children that were in, you know, if they saw them in the yard playing or anything like that, they would spit at them. And when we arrived first...
And saw that happening.
Yes, and when we arrived first and we'd walk up, the villagers would spit at us because we were helping these... They call them pigs.
Did you find that...
I found that very disturbing. But my first time walking into the orphanage and seeing the children, I was just shocked. I was shocked at what I seen. The smell first was awful. It was like a swimming pool smell, like the chlorine and ammonia and all that kind of smell together. It was overwhelming, I have to say. My heart broke looking at them because they were so deformed and they were so mentally disabled. They had institutionalized autism because some of them never spoke because of the trauma they went through. And a lot of them had twisted limbs from being tied to the cots. We've seen them tied to the chairs and stuff like that. It was heartbreaking. And to work with the Romanian government was very, very difficult. We had a couple of years of really hard work trying to make their mindset change and how these children deserved to be treated, that they were human beings after all, and that they needed dignity and, freedom, and not to be in this orphanage.
How did the government treat you?
Not very well at the start. Very, very difficult to deal with them. They were very, very difficult. A lot of red tape. And but it took years, absolute years, before we eventually got them to close the orphanage. But we worked hard with the government itself. And now the children are out of the orphanage and they're all in group homes. Now they're still all handicapped. A lot of them are very severely handicapped. And will always be for the rest. Some of them still haven't spoken. Yeah.
Now, we would have seen it on the television.
Yes.
We were horrified, I'm sure, to see it in reality.
The reality was
incredible.
The reality was just shocking. That's all the word I can say. It was absolutely shocking. I can still see them. I can feel it. I remember years after as I said, they're all in group homes, but we went back to the orphanage before it was converted into an old folks home. And we walked into it and we actually could feel the presence of the children. And one of the girls was going up the stairs and she actually could feel something. When we used to go visit them, they'd always touch us because they loved our feel of our skin, and they always assumed that we were going to have sweeties, which we would have. We'd always have something in our pockets for them. But they always loved touching you and smelling you because you smelled so nice. Do you know what I mean? And one of the girls actually could feel the children touching her. But that was the ghosts of the children that were still there. And you know what I mean? It still has that eerie feeling about it. Do you know, even though now it's an old folks home. But the the children in the at night in the orphanage, the children wouldn't have, there'd be no supervision. They'd be on their own, and there was no windows. There was windows, but there was no glass in them. It was just bars. So it'd be freezing. So in the morning, there'd be quite a few. Some of them would be dead in the morning when they'd go in to check on them. And they'd be just taken out of the room and dumped into an open grave. It was a mass grave at the side of the orphanage. And we later on opened a big body plot in the local graveyard, and we put in a lot of the bodies into the grave. Now, it's heartbreaking. I go back and I stand over that grave and I actually cry.
How long is it since you've been over there?
About 2 years.
Would you go back again?
Yeah. Yeah, because I know we changed our lives. And they know us. And
Chernobyl, tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, we started doing the Chernobyl project. I'm not really sure. We were still, obviously, it's all going on while we're having our own children.
Was that during the Eddie Roach time?
Yes. That's when it started. We started that as well. And I got involved in that, through that as well. And I had this little girl that came to me. I'll never forget her. She was a beautiful child. Her name was Ira. And she came to us. She was probably about 5 or 6 when she started coming. And she came to us every year since, until she outgrew the system, because at 16, they weren't allowed to come anymore. So we had her every year, and every year we'd wait for her to arrive, and she would be just so animated when she'd see us. But her...
And would you go to the airport and...
No, they were brought down to Dundalk.
We go
pick them up. And there was a bus, like, that would take them down and all their little belongings and stuff like that. But my God, we would have a summer of just content with her. She was amazing. Now, when she came first, she had no English at all. But she was good sign language. So we got on grand, like, because it was all sign language and stuff. But she had good English by the time she left us. And
how long had you got her?
Well, we had her from, she was about 6, about 16. So we did it for a long time. And then she left, and I really couldn't do it anymore, in a sense, because we were so attached to her. But the ironic thing was, a few years later, I'd say she was about 18, 19, and we got an invite to her wedding. And we couldn't make it, obviously, but it was lovely to get this invitation to her wedding. She actually married a Russian soldier, and she sent us a photograph of her, and it was absolutely stunning. She was beautiful. But she was a lovely, lovely child, and it was a lovely thing. I loved doing it. Because you knew that health-wise, her health was going to improve, because she was in Ireland for 6 weeks, do you know, and it was great. So I enjoyed that project.
Now, I could talk to you all day, but just to move on just a little bit, that how would you, if somebody's listening to this and they would like to foster, I'm sure you would recommend it, but they've got to know, maybe, I'm not going to say the pitfalls, but could be pitfalls.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would definitely encourage people, if you really think you want to, if you want to know, obviously you need to want to do it, and you need to have the love of children and be prepared to have challenges in your life, because some of the children will be challenging. But if you have that in you, and your partner and yourself are willing and able to do it, you should apply. Then when you apply, you get at least 6 to 8 weeks training. Because now there's all so many different, the health and safety and the child care plan and, safe care plan and all that. There's a lot more involved than when I started. But we did all those programs, even though we're fostering for years and stuff like that. So, definitely would recommend just to get in touch with Tulsa, because there is a big shortage of foster parents. They are looking
because
for them.
You definitely don't hear so many kids been fostered these days.
Yeah, no, there is. There's quite a few now. But there is a shortage of foster parents. There's also a shortage of social workers. So, like, the system isn't perfect, but it's working, you know. So if you want to, definitely I would highly recommend doing it. But be prepared for challenges.
You made a point there about both the parents have to. There's no such thing as maybe the husband saying, well, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, no.
That is not the way it works.
It won't work. It won't work unless both of you are behind it. Now, having said that, it doesn't have to be male and female. mum and dad. They can be people that are partners, like male partners and female partners. Do you know what I mean? They can foster. Do you know, you don't have to be like in a marriage, or you don't have to be married, or you could be a single parent or whatever. You know, years ago it used to be you had to be married and whatever, and it was a mum and dad situation. But that has completely changed now. So if you're in a relationship with either male or female or single parent or whatever, you can apply. And it could work for some people. Do you know what I mean? So, but if it is a partnership, it has to be a team. They have to be on the singing from the same hymn sheet. They'll have to, do you know what I mean? It's no use that the wife maybe or the mother of the house wanting to do
it.
Or yeah. It has to be, yeah, because it will be challenging. But it's really well worth it. To be honest, I would say I have no regrets in my life. I have no regrets looking after the children. It was my role in life. As I said, I wanted to be a teacher. Maybe that was the way I was to teach. Do you understand? I wasn't a teacher in the sense that I'm at a school,
because
but I'm a teacher.
As you said, you took
yeah.
a turn at the
I
time.
I took the turn, yeah. And this is it. Like, you don't know what way your life is going to evolve. You say, like, well, make that decision. Will I make that decision? Sometimes the decisions you make are wrong, and sometimes they're right. But the time that I wanted to go into the role of being a teacher, and then my dad and say, no, no, we need the money. And we did at the time. We needed to, you know. And though the factories in the 60s were booming, and you actually earn more than a teacher in a way in the factories, and you so in a way when you have a struggling family and you need money, you're going to have to choose the options of you know.
Do you ever think maybe if you had to go the other road as a teacher at that time, that you would have done all the good work you have done?
Well, see, this is it. You don't know what way that role would have went, and as I said, I wouldn't have met Larry, and you know, I might never have fostered or done any of that kind of stuff. I don't know, but that is obviously was my road. My road was that direction, straight into the fostering, looking after children and nurturing them. So do you know what I mean? And I've no regrets. I actually enjoyed every year that I've had all the children and stuff like that. Now I'm getting older, and we're obviously still currently fostering. Another few years we'll probably be retiring, and then, but this is where you need the new blood coming in and the new generations taking over and looking after them.
So what is the first thing people should do?
Oh, yeah, as I said, apply to Tulsa.
Tulsa.
Yeah, yeah, and put in your app. They'll come see you or whatever, and you fill in your application forms, and then you have a little bit of training to do. And it is worth doing the training, but you have to be aware. Don't go in blindfolded to it.
And just if there is somebody listening to us and they would like to chat to you about it, would you be able to do that?
Absolutely, no problem at all. Anything that they want to know or whatever. I'm a lot of years doing it now, so I would have great experience of fostering and looking after children. So if they want to have a chat with me, I have no problem with that. I'd be delighted, actually, to help anyone else on their journey in life, because you don't know what you're capable of doing until you start doing it.
Colette, can I thank you very much indeed
not
for talking to me? And I never thought I'd talk to you without mentioning Marathon, but we're not.
We'll leave that for another day.
Listen to lots more epic interviews at gatheringheritage.com.